Okay. You want me to comment on it?
Sure.
Okay, when I first... Do you have a tape recorder on?
Yes, sir.
When I first... The opening made me think of... you know, it's like an odd rhythm. I think it was in 5 or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then it ended in 6 and had a little 7 or put another 5 in there. But made me think of Gary Burton.
Oh, yeah.
You know, what he might be doing now. Mm-hmm. I don't know if this was recorded right now. I mean, just, you know, in the 80s, and maybe I had a feeling maybe it was recorded around 79 or 80, mm-hmm. at least. And I didn't think of Gary Burton because of the vibraphone solo, because when I first heard his entrance, or if it was him, if it was he, that approach. I've only seen Gary in live once, really, at the Village Gate. He's playing upstairs at the gate, top uh-huh. of the gate. Uh-huh. And
you recognize the soprano?
Now the soprano, it's hard to recognize that one. I just wonder if it was the guy who plays with Miles.
Bill Evans.
Bill Evans. I wonder if it was him, but I'm not sure. Yeah. But it sounds. The whole piece in general sounds like it's in the Gary Burton kind of
yeah.
groove, you know. And
did you think it was creative or interesting or not?
I think it was mainly kind of in a clinically dominated in a sense, you know,
mm-hmm.
But well put together and as a mm-hmm. you know, piece of jazz representative music that comes out in today's time,
mm-hmm.
where it's not long and drawn out. That's one thing I like about it. It wasn't long and drawn out.
Yeah.
It was a or anything. It doesn't have to be jazz. Anything that's really long and drawn out and repetitive or
yeah.
redundant, especially when it comes to like taking solos, improvised solos.
yeah.
You have two bookends, you have a solo in the middle for miles and miles, and you have two bookends at the, you know, the head, and you play the head and
yeah.
you go out again. That,
yeah,
that's just about gone, I think. So that the main thing I liked about it was it's it was to the point,
yeah.
regardless of how, whatever the clinical ingredient there was in it, you know.
Yeah.
And it was, what I liked about it was happy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, so I'm going to dig underneath things that people used to stop at years ago.
Yeah.
They stop at, well, it's too clinical for me, so I can't, or it's too academic or something, or
yeah.
Bookish or planned or something like that. Or so tearing away all those.
Yeah,
those
like
things that the
yeah.
other people years in the 60s and 70s, I mean, people
yeah.
who did this kind of interview or, you know, blindfold test.
But that doesn't bother you, right?
No, because I have to tear away the, you know, I have to look underneath now,
yeah.
you know, and see what it gives off. It, you know, it
yeah.
exhumes happiness and something like that. That's the main thing.
How would you rate it?
For an up feeling, for like a, you know, positive something,
yeah.
I'd say 2.5.
Okay, good. That was Ernie Watts on okay. That's it.
Yeah, okay. Oh, man, that's it. So many people in there. I mean, you know.
Good afternoon, Ernie Feather's office.
I heard the little bit of, you know, like the kind of way McCoy Tyner used to play the piano.
Uh-huh.
A little bit. But he whoever's playing the piano on that piece, there was certain kind of right hand bracket things that he or she was doing that McCoy wouldn't do. And I thought of Toshiko.
Oh.
You know, because the last time I saw her playing at the gate, she was playing solo piano at the gate.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and she was, she uses the pedal a lot on the acoustic piano and the left hand, like she's playing behind John Coltrane a little bit.
Uh-huh.
And when I heard the sax opening, the saxes, I was thinking about super sax. I think super sax would play more strongly and have a more bebop oriented phrasing, you know.
Yeah.
Even though this was kind of like a Spanish kind of feeling, the opening and everything. Uh-huh. So I think these musicians were a little more classically oriented in the opening. And I don't know who they were, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe Tom Scott might know a lot of people who could fit in, who could make that kind of something like that, a record like that. I don't want to put it in any musical category, like this is strictly jazz or this, and you know, but it's a kind of a mulligan stew.
Yeah, right. It was. How would you rate it?
I'd say it's just like a stew to me is like kind of interesting to taste, you know.
Yeah.
And but I wouldn't have my whole meal with that kind of stew. I just give it one. I'll give it one star.
Yeah. Well, actually,
and this one I hear two distinct saxophone styles. One seems more West Coast oriented, and the other one seems more East Coast oriented. The other one, the East Coast oriented, sounds like it could come from kind of Dexter Gordon-ish something.
Mm-hmm.
And the West Coast has a more Al Cohen approach. Even in the trombones, at first I was thinking about Bob Brookmeyer. I was thinking about that, you know.
Yeah.
And I was trying to listen for the valve trombone feeling in it. Whoever was taking the trombone solo. Especially when it came to moving around in the faster notes. Well, it sounds like something that's from back there around in the 50s,
yeah,
early 50s, Philly Joe Jones once played a song or wrote something that sounded something like that, but he had more breaks in it, drum breaks.
Uh-huh.
And because he and I, we had a jam session, we had a gig together at Birdland one Monday night.
Uh-huh.
Philly Joe Jones, myself, and Kenny Dorham.
Really?
Yeah. It was Philly Joe's, you know, he called me and asked me if I want to, you know, do it.
Yeah.
So, and he played a song something like that. So, I think the swing part of it, the rhythm section part, whoever was playing in the rhythm section could have been more strong, you know, more up front. And it would give it seems like the horns were all pulling the rhythm.
Yeah.
You know. So, and I have a feeling that it was a date that was kind of off the cuff, put together off the cuff, you know, like a, not I don't say you had to have a lot of rehearsals and everything, but not, you know.
Yeah.
So with that kind of thought in mind, I've never been in a spot where myself where I had to, I could have any reason for throwing a record date together, a record session together, or a song on the record session. You know, just throw one song, just throw it together.
Yeah.
Seems like it's pretty much thrown kind of together. So, for some of the, I say some of the fingering, saxophone fingerings that I heard in the solo part, I give it a, I think 1 star.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, at first when I heard the opening, the entrance of the soprano sax, I was thinking about Steve Lacy, you know, but he plays with a little more gusto, and after the signature of the song, I call that first part the signature of the song, when he went into this, I call it the descriptive part, the improvisation. I think Steve Lacy would have been more on target, especially if they were, even without chord changes.
Yeah.
Whoever was playing the soprano, I think, likes Steve Lacy.
Yeah.
You know, and but the everybody in that group, they were all playing on the beat, more or less. And as Miles would say, it's nice when you can play across the beat and across the bar lines. And it sounds to me as if they were exploring trying to explore something that has been explored already.
Yeah.
You know. Going outside, so to speak, when they used the word in the 60s a lot, going outside.
Yeah.
I don't think it was a good job. I mean, I have to be, you know, candid. I think that'll help by saying that it wasn't a good job, but they're trying to go outside. It wasn't, you know, on target.
Let's add for the record that during the drum solo, you asked me to skip forward, right?
Yeah.
You're getting bored.
Yeah, it was I heard some rudiments there that it's like in the beginnings of taking drum lessons. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I know some people, musicians who play well, try to do a piece of music as if they don't know how to play their instruments. If they make believe you don't know how to play your instrument, maybe we'll get to something, get the essence of something.
Yeah.
Miles used to say that sometimes, and make believe you can't play.
Really?
You know, he said that's what he said he was doing that sometimes. You know, make believe he couldn't play the trumpet, and because it was hard to do. But I heard him do some things, and it sounded like a lot of real love was going through it, and not professionalism, but the amateur thing.
Yeah.
When the first time I discovered that amateur means someone who loves something.
That's right.
For the love of it, not for the money. You know.
Yeah.
And I heard that happen with that Miles Davis group a lot, you know. A lot of the guys, Herbie Hancock would just put his hands down and not play for a while. You remember that time when Herbie said he didn't know what to play?
Yeah.
And then when he did play something, he was like a little kid, like a little buddy was in the audience, it really communicated.
Yeah.
You know. So all of his classical training went out the window and something else, the real things, you know.
Yeah.
So if they were trying to do that, still,
it didn't happen. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Sounds like no stars?
No, yeah, that's a no star. It sounds like it for you, too.
I'll tell you later what it was. Let's see. What else is my list. Thank you.
They're gonna go out now, huh? Trumpet doesn't make a song. But maybe. That sound in there's a baritone player from New York. He used to play with he used to play with Thad Jones, Mel Lewis band. I can't think of his name. Jay Cameron.
No.
What's his name?
You're probably thinking of Pepper Adams.
Pepper Adams, yeah. Who is Jay Cameron? This thing came to my head. Did he play baritone? Yeah, Pepper Adams. That reminds me of Pepper Adams, whoever was playing that baritone sax. Mm-hmm. And the pianist reminds me of, funny, it reminds me of Horace Silver. Mm-hmm. The right hand has that, you know, and the left hand has a little Thelonious Monk influence in the chords, and the way the, mm-hmm. the, you know, the weight of the chords and the choice of notes. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like the way Horace used to write.
Yeah.
At a certain time, he used to write something like that. And he had the... It sounds like it's heavily Horace Silver influenced, mm-hmm. you know. The alto sax, we were playing the alto sax, reminded me of Jerry Dodgerman. Remember Jerry Dodgerman?
Oh, yeah.
Dodgerman, I was saying. It sounded like, you know. So I might be off, but these... Those are the immediate things that I got. Because Horace liked the steadiness. The drummer had that kind of steadiness. I think the steadiest kind of thing that Horace had at one time was when he had Lewis Hayes playing the drums
yeah.
with him. And then after that, all the other drummers who followed, he insisted that they keep some of that, whatever that Lewis Hayes had in there. I felt some of that steady thing from the drummer in there.
Yeah.
And I think I give it 2 stars.
Sounds fair.
Mm-hmm. Give it 2 stars. Baritone player was really connecting up with the change is nice.
Yeah.
Gatto Barbieri. Especially that tenor sound, unless a lot of some other guys are coming along doing the same kind of sound.
Yeah.
To me, it sounds like Gatto. Even though I heard them on soundtracks of Last Tango in Paris, they had, you know, everything kind of souped up so with echo and reverb and all that.
Yeah.
And it sounded like he's all over the screen. But for recording, if that's him, probably get a little more microcosmic of what he does on the screen.
Yeah.
So, to me, this is like the same kind of mini build-up of Ravel's Bolero. You start any kind of
yeah.
build-up. So it's really Latin Bolero, not Bolero, but that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it sounded like Gatto Barbieri and like repetition going on without you know, a repetition is something that keeps building and building. For that effect, which is many more different ways to do that now and become be more interesting for achieving what they achieved that way, which is very kind of, you know, mundane, mediocre way of doing it. I say 1.5 stars.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And trying to conjure up some excitement with the embellishments that were going around, you know, sax wise. The use of the saxophone, I think there would have been another choice of instrument to use, you know, and another attitude or something like that.
Yeah. Do you think the repetition at the beginning was too repetitious?
Yeah, but it was too much in the beginning, too much of the same exact repetition.
Same figure, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I was wondering when they were going to stop.
Yeah.
I only heard it once before.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my goodness, we haven't had any more than 2 stars. I'm sorry to disappoint you.
No.
I didn't do it deliberately. I had no idea how the ratings would come out. I thought you would like some of them more than you did. Let me ask you a question. What, if I had played it, what would you have given 5 stars at any time in history, you know?
Let's see, from America here.
From anywhere.
From anywhere. Let's see. Providing that you heard it, let's see.
There must be some things in your collection that you...
Oh, am I? Okay, let me go back to my collection.
Any record you've ever heard in your life?
Yeah.
That you would really think worth 5 stars.
You know, it's 5 stars.
What?
It's a thing of. They put out on Miles, but the different groups that have gone through Miles, you know.
The Prestige package?
I think that's it.
12 albums?
No, it's not 12. They only gave me one. I was in Paris and they gave me one. They have it on a cassette too. It's with Blue Christmas on it.
Oh, really?
Devil May Care.
Oh, yeah.
Then the other one that the song Jackie Unclean wrote.
Oh.
And then it's a Coltrane on one thing with Miles and all that. But then, you know, it's like really a mixed, you know, that's a nice 5-star thing.
Mm-hmm.
I just have it, you know, at home. And I was listening to it. I didn't look at anything. I turned it on and I said, hey, that was Jackie McLean playing real good, you know,
mm-hmm.
and with Miles, of course. I think Dave Schilkraut is on one.
Oh, really?
Remember Dave, you know? Not just a saxophone arena, I'm not just going to saxophone, but then there were other things, a piano, like Victor Feldman and somebody else. And I think it's out here in the USA.
Where did you get it?
I was at CBS in Paris,
and they
laid it on us.
That's a different collection, because I don't think those particular things you listed are all together on one album here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like Blue Christmas, I don't think is available at all. I know that's the one Bob Doro sings.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Anyway,
yeah.
It's an interesting reaction. Wouldn't you be anything of Miles from the period when you were with him?
What was that question again?
Anything from Miles of the 60s when you were in the group. You wouldn't consider any of those 5 stars?
Oh, yeah, some of those things. I was just trying to stay away from that, you know. I was thinking about things that I haven't been involved with playing-wise at all.
Yeah.
5 stars, I give those Dizzy Gillespie big band things 5 stars, you know.
The early big band?
Yeah, those early big band things.
I
think they're listening to that stuff in schools now and in colleges and everything.
Oh, yeah.
They're listening to it, but what I hear coming out is it seems like what they're doing is they're listening to this stuff and they're applying it to making what they're doing today doing the best, you know, the best kind of thing, whatever new wave or whatever it is. I hear a smatter of good work and some kind of new wave stuff. Seems like they have studied Dizzy Gillespie's big band and Stan Kenton, the whole thing, you know, how you approach a break, how you approach a blare, a trumpet blare, you know, those brackets and an expressive statement.
Yeah.
And it's coming, you know, it's coming through, you know.
Yeah.
It's a band.
Well, that'll do. Let me turn this off and I'll put on another tape for the interview. Turn this off.